Our mission is a simple one. Era 5050 want to see women represented on stage and screen in equal numbers to men.
Here, on the New Era podcast, we will be talking to the women and men of the moment who are working towards equality, celebrating their success and discussing the solutions we can use to help move the industry forward.
Hello there, I'm Ellie Yates.
And I'm Rose Riley.
And we are your hosts for this, the New Era podcast.
Thank you for joining us.
Welcome.
We wanted to just give you a little bit of background on us. I am an actor and I've been involved with Era 5050 for just over a year now. And I got involved through Ellie. How did you get involved?
Yeah, a friend from drama school said I should come along to the meeting. And I'd heard about, this was about 2016, and I'd heard about the organisation before from seeing, do you remember when Denise Goff won an award and had the T-shirt on?
Yeah.
And people were wearing the badge? Mm-hmm. And so I'd been intrigued about that. And then, yeah, I went along to my first meeting, which was at the National Theatre, probably, 2016. And then we both worked together on putting together the BAFTA launch event, which was February last year.
Yeah, and the BAFTA launch event was essentially, it was the official launch, really, wasn't it, of Era 5050 and the campaign to have equal representation on our stages and screens. And so there was a lot of people invited from the industry, the big broadcasters, from theatre, casting directors, writers, actors, and they all came to BAFTA and essentially heard the mission statement of the campaign and the solutions. That's what Era is all about, isn't it, really, is the solutions to try and make this happen.
So we presented them with some facts, like men outnumber women 2-1 in acting roles on screen at the moment, and after some research that we did ourselves, we found that it's actually more like 3-1 on kids' TV, which is quite an incredible statistic. And yet we presented them with these facts that I think people probably knew instinctively, but to see them written down made a bit of an impact. And that, as you say, we wanted to talk about how we can change this, so it's not about a bunch of women moaning about not having work. This is a way of us offering ways out and solutions for the decision makers.
But it's still very much a grassroots organisation. We still meet in the National Theatre Cafe.
We don't have an office.
No office space. We're still scrounging for meeting rooms when we have kind of more formal meetings with the core committee. But it started with, I suppose, the call to arms started with a text message, didn't it, from Lizzie Berrington, who, oh God, she's been in loads of things, in Bruges.
The Office.
Yeah.
She's been in everything, you'll know her.
She's wonderful. And it started off with her, texting around her phone book of actresses.
Yeah, so let me just, should I read it?
Yeah.
I think it's quite nice.
Yeah.
So this is a text message that she sent out to all the actresses in her address book. To my dearest friends and colleagues, actresses, all of us, it's Elizabeth Berrington here, and I feel compelled to write this brief text in the hope of promoting a further conversation. I've just seen Suffragette and feel sickened that 100 years on, women are still earning, on average, 20% less than men. In our own profession, this can be very much higher. There is no wage transparency, yet we carry on knowingly expecting this disparity. Could we? Would you join with me somehow to discuss this further? Also, let's discuss female quotas in film and TV, perhaps. I'm the breadwinner in my home. I think we all deserve more. I've never before felt compelled to reach out in this manner. If you too feel as I do, would you search your address book, pass on the text to actresses close to you, and let's see where this takes us. With respect, Elizabeth Berrington. And from that call to arms, there was a meeting at the Soho Theatre. Lots of people were there, incredible actresses, Polly Kemp and Lizzie and Deirdre and Karen, who we're going to speak to in a little bit as our first interviewee, were all there at that meeting at the Soho and found that while there was a lot of anger in the room, there was also a lot of passion and commitment to make a positive change.
So that's probably a good place for us to start. We spoke to the founders, Polly Kemp, who is probably best known for The Thick of It.
Or This Time with Alan Partridge, most recently.
Yeah, you can check that out. Deirdre Mullins, who is probably best known for her being a regular character Naomi in Channel 4's Man Down, mm-hmm. And Karin Painter, who is Era 5050's creative director, and she works in the jewellery industry, but she has essentially worked from the beginning of the campaign on everything from branding to all the other creative endeavours mm-hmm. that has been needed to set up Era 5050. So we spoke to them a few weeks ago at the National Theatre about how and why the campaign started.
So for the people who don't know or who aren't sure, what is Era 5050?
Well, it's the equal representation for actresses. I think we started from a position of numbers, mm-hmm. just more women on stage. Mm. On screen, because the research that we had read and the research that we did showed that there were two men for every one woman.
And on children's television, that's more like three male characters for every one female character. So that's pretty devastating for our young people growing up.
And given that the population is, you know, by a percentage point, predominantly female, that seems wrong.
Yeah.
So, I mean, it was something that we felt, you know, as you're... You know, careers begin to dwindle, so you begin to experience it. So, you know, we knew experientially that there was less work for us, and then the data just provided
shall
us
we,
with
shall
the
we
evidence.
Hit them with some amazing facts?
Yeah, hit us with some facts.
I think I knew this until I got into this mm-hmm. campaign. So yeah. I think I'll just interrupt here and just say that it's really good to know this fact that I don't think I knew until I really got involved in the campaign, which is that, you know, men and women have sort of equalish amounts of work in their sort of 20s and 30s are pretty good too. But then once you move up to 42 to 65, then you're looking at women have about one-fifth the amount of words that men have, equivalent dialogue. So that tells you that even the statistic that there are two men on screen to every one woman, really what you're seeing in the detail of that is that it's young women are on screen, whereas old women are hardly on screen, or mm-hmm. in inverted commas.
Yeah, and probably actually an awful lot of those younger women are less so maybe right now, but because the conversation is moving a lot more to, you know, to strong lead female mm. characters. However, sort of till the very recent past, those lead women would definitely be a sidekick, an adjunct, a victim. It wouldn't necessarily be a part that you could say this person really has real agency.
Absolutely.
You know, so for us it is, you know, it is qualitative, it's quantitative mm. and qualitative. Mm. That's
So you don't want equal numbers of women on screen if they're not saying or doing anything.
Right. Exactly.
So to go back to that point, we started off with just the numbers, did some research, found some facts, and then what happens as you develop as a campaign is you start to begin to look at root cause. So mm. I'd say actually, as a campaign, we also know that unless we have gender equality at sort of key creative roles, you know, so that's commissioners, producers, that's definitely writers and definitely directors, you're not going to see the kind of representation of women on screen in numbers with agency that we see as true equality. So as a campaign, we campaign for the equal representation of actresses. However, we work in coalition with other campaign groups that are looking at other areas of equality within our industry above and below the line. So, you know, we champion Directors UK, we champion the Writers Guild.
Act for Change,
mm. PIPA, yep. You know, all of these organisations are part of a movement that support and help us to achieve true gender equality. Mm.
So a massive thank you to Polly, Karin and Deirdre for coming in and talking to us. It was a fantastic conversation that ended up being a lot more in-depth and juicy than we had expected. So we've decided to just put in a tiny little taste of you in this episode, and we will put the whole interview into its own podcast in a couple of weeks' time. So we'll release that then.
So every week we're going to speak to a special guest and interview them. And our first guest for this episode is the actress and co-creator of Harlots, Alison Newman. We thought she'd be a really good person to talk to because she's an actress, but also because she decided to make her own show from the ground up with the brilliant writer Moira Buffini. And the show itself is a brilliant celebration of womanhood in all its glory. It's a big ensemble cast. And yeah, we just wanted to talk to her a bit about how you go about creating your own work. She also came to our launch event in BAFTA, so we spoke to her a little bit about her response to that and maybe how that's affected her writing. So we are here with Alison Newman, actress, writer and producer. Alison has worked successfully on the stage in the West End with the RSC, the Royal Court, and on screen she's probably best known for her work as ruthless lesbian football agent Hazel on Footballers' Wives, and as the Lucy Beale murder case investigator, DSI Samantha Keeble in EastEnders. In 2016, is that right, she co-created the series Harlots with the writer Moira Buffini, having first worked together and forged a friendship in 2001 on the play Love Play at the RSC, written by Moira and starring Alison. Produced by Monumental Pictures, Harlots is an 18th century drama about the world's oldest profession, with an all-female directing and writing team and a large ensemble cast featuring incredible actresses Samantha Morton, Leslie Manville, Jessica Brown Finley, and joined in the second series by Liv Tyler. It's a hugely successful show, shining a light on a diverse range of female stories with universal themes of power, family, ambition, and revenge. In September this year, it was renewed for a third series. So, Alison, welcome to our podcast.
Hi.
And thank you for letting us come and use your home and talk to you.
Yeah, you're both very, very welcome. I actually met Moira at National Youth Theatre.
Oh, no way.
Wow.
And I was 17 and she was, I think, a year older. And we formed what a lot of people thought was quite an unlikely friendship. And it has sustained ever since. But yes, I've worked with her a few times and before Harlots, and she's an incredible writer, and it's always great to say her words.
Yeah.
It's what I say, you know, so yes.
So did you keep track of each other from kind of
then on? Yeah. I think maybe we had a year when we both went off to drama school or college or whatever, but yeah, no, we've been friends for decades, many decades. Yeah.
So where did the idea of Harlots come from? I mean, it started filming in 2016.
Yeah.
When did you first have the idea?
Well, so, you know, I'm an actor and I've had and still have, you know, a healthy career. But I noticed when I hit 40, things really started to change. The parts got less interesting. I also noticed that a lot of women that I knew who were actors who would go up for very different parts to me in their 30s, suddenly we were all going up for the same part, usually quite a small part.
Yeah.
When we hit 40s, it's like you hit 40 and we all become the same woman.
Mm.
And I know that's a sweeping generalisation, but it felt a bit like that. So I got quite frustrated about that and wanted to keep working within the industry. And I wanted to, I had a long conversation with Moira, where I just talked about how frustrating it was. And years before, I'd mentioned to her about some research I'd done about sex workers in the 18th century. And she said, why don't you just... She basically said, you haven't got anything else to do. Why don't you spend... It was a very jolly evening. That sounds a bit harsh, but, you know, we were going to
laugh. It was over a bottle of wine.
Yes, it was over a bottle of wine. We're having a laugh about it. And she said, why don't you look back into that world again? So I did. And I spent quite a few months just reading and researching, which was a fantastic distraction from being out of work, for starters. But the more I found out about these women, the more fascinated I became by them and just started to see an opportunity for a female-led drama from a female point of view with a cast of women of all ages, shapes and sizes, and was delighted to discover as well ethnic diversity. So. Yeah. It became an obsession. My husband started calling me a whoreball, and he was right. I became absolutely obsessed by it and discovered that these women, they contributed hugely to the national economy of Britain in the 18th century. And that's when I went back to Moira. So this is, I don't know, quite a few months later. And I just said, OK, I've done what you suggested. Will you now create this show with me. So she took a bit of persuading, but she came on board and we started taking the real women that I'd found and turning them into our fictional characters. It was really important to us that the older women should be really central characters and not just mothers and grandmothers.
And were those the roles that you found that were kind of, when you were talking earlier about this, the roles that you were going up for?
Yeah.
Was it the, you kind of wanted to move away from the stereotypical roles that you,
Yeah, woman on doorstep.
Yeah.
Yeah.
You know, I don't know, pretty much lots of, I always, you know, exposition characters.
Victim's mum.
Victim's mum. Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Or person helping the maverick policeman.
Yeah.
You know, the maverick detective, that kind of thing. Mm-hmm. So we found, and at the more we looked into the world, we started with the boards, the madams, and these women were extraordinary, the real ones. And so we started to create the characters of Lydia Quigley, and who's played in our show by Leslie Manville, and Margaret Wells, who is a different class. She's a slightly lower class board, who is played by Samantha Morton, and they are both extraordinary in the show. And those were our starting points. Mm-hmm. So a woman in her, I don't know, round about 40, mm-hmm. and who's Margaret Wells, and a woman who is, you know, 50s, late 50s, who is Lydia Quigley. And it was so exciting to create these kick-ass women. Mm. Also, to create women who, well, it's the parts that would normally be played by blokes, you know, because they're not good in the classic sense of the word good. Mm. You know, they do some dubious stuff. And it was women against women. Not just always women supporting women. And from then we created the Wells family. So we created Lucy Wells, who's Margaret's daughter, who's in her teens, and Charlotte Wells, famous courtesan played by Jessica Brown Findlay, who was in her 20s. And it just kept growing after that. And before we knew it, we had this world of incredible characters. And all of the women were thought of first.
It's a huge cast, actually, isn't it? It's a big ensemble.
Yeah, it is big. I mean, it's not as big when we first started to develop it. It was always going to be bigger. But, you know, you do have to adhere to budgets, unfortunately. But I think sort of at last count over the first two series, I'm sorry, this isn't an exact figure, but I think, you know, 30 significant parts for women, fewer for men. The men in our show are wonderful, I have to say, but the show is absolutely... from the female point of view. So, you know, that's how it panned out.
So was it a conscious decision? Was it important to you to have women directing this story from a female point of view?
We didn't sit down and say, it's got to be women. It has to be women. And the same with the writers, actually, but that was how it evolved. You know, the people that we met who came into the room, very quickly we realised this is how it should be. You know, we met a lot of writers. We met a lot of quite new writers. And it was the women who came into the room, not always the most established writers that we met either, who just got the show and got the tone of it, you know, because we didn't want to do a show where we were judging women for working in a very difficult industry, which seems to happen quite a lot with shows about sex workers. The female voice was very strong. And then obviously hiring directors came much, much, much later. Yeah, again, it just felt like the right thing to do. And it brought a different atmosphere to set, I think. I am sure there are men who would have done the job brilliantly, you know, absolutely. But yeah, we're dealing with a sensitive subject. There isn't that much nudity in our show, but there's quite a lot of sex. And we always wanted our actresses to play sex workers and not feel like them. You know, to feel safe in the environment, to and I think that comes across, actually.
So can you tell us a bit about the journey from the idea to actually getting it commissioned?
Yeah, so Moira had worked with Alison Owen, who was then Ruby Films, but is now Monumental, who are our wonderful, wonderful, wonderful production company. This was in 2012. And we went to see her. It's very nerve-wracking. Pitched the idea and she loved it. And we got a meeting very quickly. This, I appreciate this also. I couldn't believe it. It's like, how can it be this easy? little was I to know. And we got a meeting very quickly with a network. And they loved it. And it was put on the slate to be developed. And they held it, it was there for 2 years. And lots of rewrites were done of the first episode and discussions of the tone. And it was incredibly helpful because it did craft the show, the basis, like the foundation of the show that exists now. But after 2 years, we parted company, and because there were differences in opinion of tone of the show. We have a phrase that we use a lot on Harlots, which is misery porn. And even though we're dealing with sort of quite big, sometimes quite melodramatic themes and ideas, there's a lot of death, there's a lot of vengeance. We always wanted the show to have a sense of humour and, you know, people in difficult situations get through by laughing at that. And yeah, the Georgians were very witty and loved words, so we wanted to keep that going. Mm. So our ideas of tone were a bit different. So we went to another company. We were lucky enough to be picked up again by a different network. And they really did help us shape the show. But again, after a year, that didn't happen because, you know, ultimately, you can have a great team at a network just loving what you're doing and helping you and being brilliant, but it's usually one person who decides whether to commission it or not. And, you know, you do hear sometimes that we've got our female show. You might not hear that officially, but that's what you hear. Meanwhile, Hulu in America, which was really surprising, just loved it. They were trying to change the way that they were broadcasting and they wanted to create more original drama. Alongside our show, they were creating Handmaid's Tale. Yeah. So, you know.
So that's another female drama.
That's a very female drama.
Two at once.
Yes, no, exactly. And so we had the American side all locked down, but we still needed a British broadcaster. And ITV Encore, right sort of at the final hour, stepped up and said, OK, we will do this. I am immensely grateful to Encore because I'm not sure we'd have actually ever made the show without them. Very long answer, short answer. I think from 5 years from thought to screen, yeah, about that, maybe a little bit more. And there was a lot of just, it was really, really discouraging at times. It was, but I'm quite like a small dog with a chew, and I just knew it was a good idea. The world we'd created was felt original and, you know, a costume drama that didn't feel like a costume drama. A costume drama with so many women with a voice.
Mm. And agency.
Yeah. And agency.
Which is huge.
Especially in a show about sex work where, you know, we've seen that on screen. We've seen it loads. Usually as set dressing, quite often as, dead.
Yeah.
You know, just as a plot point and quite often for titillation. So we just hung on in there and it was quite difficult at times, but luckily it happened. And Hulu and Encore were amazing to work with. They just let us get on with it. And here we are about to start filming our third series in the new year, which is terrifyingly close, it seems.
It's great.
Exciting.
And yeah, really exciting.
Very, very exciting.
Very exciting.
So you mentioned that you heard a lot of, well, we've already got our female drama. Was there anything else that you were aware of in terms of the story or the premise of the show and also being a female strong team? Was there anything that kind of you felt was maybe gender prejudiced or...?
I think there was a real uneasiness. I think one of the reasons why it was hard to get a green light is there was a general unease about women profiting and in some cases thriving from deciding what they wanted to do with their bodies. Mm. Now, obviously, in the 18th century, the decisions were slightly different, but it was the choice then of earning a couple of quid a year as a servant or taking a chance and perhaps becoming a movie star of the era. Mm. Obviously, that's massive extremes. Those who thrived did, a lot didn't. But I think there was an unease about that. It seems to me that it is more palatable to show violence towards women on screen than it is to show women earning a buck from having sex.
It's that agency thing again.
It's agency. Yeah. Now, I don't know that that was that. I don't know whether that was the reason, and I'm possibly speaking totally out of turn. But because we refuse to be miserable about this and to judge these women and to use it as some sort of morality tale of how not to live your life, I think that made it a slightly more difficult sell. Mm. Oh, and we haven't got any men swooping in
to save the day.
No. Can we talk a little bit about, I know you and Moira came to our launch event
yes.
in February. What was your initial response to some of the information, the statistics that we presented there? And do you think it has affected in any way the way you've gone about writing the third series?
Yeah, I mean, it was an extraordinary evening and a terrifying evening as well in a lot of ways. Just hearing people's stories, hearing figures that I, you know, about the ratio of women to men, about women writers, about women directors, I found it really, really shocking, but not surprising. It's just when you hear those facts, you can't argue with facts. Yeah, and yes, I mean, you know, we're having a pretty good stab at redressing the balance with Harlots. All our writers are women, all our directors are women, huge female cast. One of the statistics that really shocked me was the difference between the ratio of male and female supporting artists. And, you know, it's like, that is the easiest thing to fix.
Yeah. And I think it's 17%.
Crazy to me. Obviously, our show, because we have a lot of women who are working in the sex industry, I don't have the statistics for our show, unfortunately. But I think we're kind of pushing towards making that a bit better. But, you know, we came away from that and had a conversation and said we must try harder, even harder, to make sure that we don't do that on our show. And I think it is that easy to fix. Those are areas that are easy to fix. We've become more colourblind with the show. I mean, for our third series, I mean, we have been fairly, fairly truthful to how it was in the 18th century. And there was a time when, there was a community in London who you never see represented, you know, sort of black people, not in costume dramas, unless they're servants. Mm. And it used to be really important to me that we were historically accurate. I've got a little less, I don't care so much about that when it comes to that, because we are the people who can change what you see on the screen. Yeah. So let's do it. That's sort of where I'm at with it.
I think, it should be an empowering thing. I think when you realise how much an effect, as a creator of TV that millions of people watch, how powerful that is. And I think part of the event was trying to empower these people to say, look, you're having this effect on the world.
Yeah, well, I came out of it inspired and a bit emotional, a bit ashamed, you know, because even though we're doing what we can, we know we're not perfect, but inspired mainly because they are easy fixes. Take a leap, hire the female director. Hire that female director to do crime. You know, that when we are meeting directors, it's shocking to me that that crime drama is that women can't do it or aren't often given the chance to do it. That really shocks me. And that women seem to be kept in daytime or continuing drama or soap, and there's nothing wrong with any of those, obviously, but take a leap. That is what I think.
So with your writers, how did you go about, because one of the excuses is, well, we can't find any female writers. How did you go about populating your writers' room with women?
Well, I have to admit, that wasn't my job to find the writers, although we all had suggestions for people that we wanted to meet. You know, just put the call out. Put the call out. There is a big and should be bigger list of fantastic female writers. Get them in the room, meet them. So what if they've not written, you know, I mean, of course they haven't written our show before because they haven't written our show before.
Yeah.
Just encourage new talent. I mean, that is one thing that, or undiscovered talent, or not used as much talent. Just get people in a room, have a conversation. You might not click. They might, you might not be right. Read the scripts, take the time, read everything that is sent to you because you never know who you're going to find. And, you know, that I think that that has been really important for the show.
Yeah, and I think that's quite apparent actually in the casting as well, is that, that even though there are the known faces, there seem to be a lot of faces that we hadn't necessarily seen in kind of big chunky roles like that.
One of the biggest joys for me, I should actually say, I didn't create Harlots to create an acting job for me.
But you were in it.
I did a teeny little cameo. I just couldn't resist. I had to get a corset on at some point.
Oh, yeah.
But it was never about that. It was about creating lots of work and good characters for women to play. One of the biggest joys was the ability to bring in new faces and, you know, really to populate the younger cast. And that was so exciting. I remember having a conversation with a casting director a couple of years ago at a party, and he said how frustrating he finds the whole casting process. You know, obviously he loves the casting process, but trying to get new talent in a room is difficult. Bring it in, I say. There is a really practical side to casting, but there is still space to bring in new faces. You know, I sort of feel like the pool will dry up if we don't start bringing in new people. So it was great. Lots of new talent. Great feeling on set, I felt. And, you know, people happy to be there.
Yeah.
Which was great.
Yeah, Ellie was saying that you were at her...
Yeah, you were at my costume fitting. Even I remember
because I was being tried for that small part.
And I thought, wow, that is incredible creative control. You're like even here for the costume fitting. I thought, but it was a really wonderful ensemble feeling to the whole thing. And
It's important that Harlot should feel like an ensemble.
Yeah. And I, you know, I didn't have a huge bit, but I felt.
You were very, very memorable. And that was also an important thing. I know it's always been important to Moira and to me, you know, it is those sort of 1-2 episode characters. Yeah. Make them count. Yeah, make it showreel worthy at the very least.
Yeah. They're all complicated, complex people. Yeah. Even those smaller parts, they felt real.
And was that a conscious decision, actually, making making each, even the smaller kind of 1-ep, 2-ep characters complex and not stereotypical? Was that something you consciously did, or was it something that you just kind of fell into when yourself and Moira were creating it?
It's got a lot to do with Moira's writing, because I don't think she could even... I think if you were to say to her, could you please just write a functional character, I think her head might explode.
Yeah.
Because... because she's...
Can't compute.
Yes, does not compute. But then, you know, if you're going to get a talented person in to play a part, what a wasted opportunity not to make that part count in some way. Mm. You know, it's all screen time. So get what you can out of it. Let them say fop doodle. You said fop doodle. Of course you did.
Yeah.
It's a wasted opportunity, I think. Functional characters, what's the point?
So you're going into your third series.
Yep.
If we could pinpoint one thing that you're really proud of, because, I mean, it's been so successful and you've...
Getting a third series, actually, is sort of pretty high up there. It feels like, you know, you get your first series, that's amazing. It's like, you know, you've got this little baby who you're very, very protective of, and then you get your second series and... toddler, and now we've got our kind of really, it's fully formed child now, Harlots. It's difficult, delightful.
Answers back.
Yeah. Absolutely doesn't do what it's told. But no, it feels, obviously we'd like to do more than three if we could, but, you know, it feels quite complete, and it's quite hard these days to to get even a second series of anything. So that's good. Mm. I'm proud that we've created employment for lots of people.
Mm. Yeah.
That's what I'm the most proud of. There you go. I got there eventually. Okay. I am proud of that. The biggest thrill is when you start receiving the unit list. And as an executive producer, I get that. And the names start filling up. And then the cast names start filling up. To me, I will never get over that.
Yeah.
It's more thrilling than getting a job as an actor.
Mm-hmm. Creating work.
Creating work. Mm-hmm. That has been the most, that's what I'm most proud of. Mm.
We have this whole strand of our campaign that's 50-50 by 2020. Mm. So that's very close now. That's like a year and a month away. As someone who creates it, what do you think do you think that's possible? And what do you think the challenges are going to be to getting producers and commissioners?
That's difficult. I mean, I do think it's possible. I know that we more than do that cast from a cast point of view.
Yeah.
Behind the camera, I don't know. I would have to count the names and see, but we don't do badly.
No.
I think, of course, it is possible. Anything is possible if you want to make it so. Mm-hmm. It is difficult. If you have a drama that is, I don't know, set in a police station, or I don't know, it's, you know, say you've got a cop show. Yeah, it's maybe more difficult. It is traditionally a more male world.
But you could balance that out across the year with another show.
Well, exactly. Yeah. Or just look at the characters and just say, okay, that guy, does he have to be a guy? Is there anything in that character that means he absolutely has to be a guy? And that guy, does he have to be a white guy? And we've been doing that a bit with Harlots. Obviously, it's a little bit more cut and dried with Harlots, weirdly. But I think especially in contemporary dramas, yes, absolutely, examine your characters. And quite often I think people will be surprised to discover how gender fluid some of these parts could be. Sometimes in Harlots, a scene won't be working properly and we can't work out what it is. And then we realise it's because we're doing what most shows do and we're telling that story in that particular scene from the male point of view, and you flip it. It's like, there's our show. There it is. And it's just sort of doing things like that.
And thinking back to your journey with Harlots from like the very, very kernel of the idea to now, is there anything that would have made it easier to get there? So obviously you're kind of at the forefront of a female heavy team with a female led project. Is there anything maybe to do with gender that would have made it easier and less complicated to get to where you are now?
Possibly. You know, people were very keen that we had more traditional love stories. Mm. And we are allowing that a little more now that, it's traditional as a love story between two sex workers or male and female sex workers. That's a complicated relationship. But yeah, more romance we heard a lot, and redemption. We heard an awful lot. Well, could you make her more likeable? And the answer to that usually was, well, do you think anybody asked if Tony Soprano could be more likeable?
What do they mean by more likeable?
Well, because I think there was very much a view that women needed to be able to relate to these women. So the audience, which they figured would be predominantly female, you know, if you make that character have difficult, complicated things to do. And we did rather throw it at the audience in the first episode. We had a woman selling her teenage daughter's virginity and entering her into the sex trade. That happened a lot then. And I think because we'd been working with the show for so long, it hadn't really occurred to us that much because it just felt like a reality. But, you know, it is this assumption that a female audience only wants to see romance, women who they could be mates with. Mm. So I think that was difficult for us because we wanted our women to be as challenging and maverick and difficult as so many big male protagonists are.
Yeah.
So we weren't prepared to compromise with that. And I think that's why it took a really long time.
And why it's such a standout show.
Mm. Thank you very much.
Yeah. Have you noticed a change? So there's lots of things that are great at the moment in terms of Bodyguard, Killing Eve. We're seeing a slight shift. Have you noticed a change?
Yeah, I mean, massively. Not massively. I have noticed a shift. It is a little more difficult to hire female writers and directors, because the work is, people are starting to direct more work, which is brilliant. Mm-hmm. We are in an incredible stable with Handmaid's Tale. You know, we do, I've always felt a bit like, kind of like the scrappy little fighter nipping at the heels of the behemoth that is Handmaid's Tale. But it was incredible to, it felt like we were part, or are part, because they always put our shows out pretty much together.
Yeah.
I felt incredibly proud to be part of what felt like an incredible shift of awareness and female-led dramas and all of that kind of thing. But it's not enough. It's a really good start, but I think there's a way to go. I think people just have to realise that women's stories are interesting.
And it's not a fad.
It's not a fad.
And they're crazy successful shows. You know,
crazy,
you know,
successful
Killing Eve
shows.
And Handmaid's Tale. And, you know, they're making money.
They are making money. Yeah. And I think you've summed it up brilliantly. It is not a fad. We are not a fad. Women are not a fad. Mm. So let's see some more of them. Mm.
Thank you so much, Alison.
Absolute
for,
pleasure.
Letting us come and ask you all these questions about your work. It's been brilliant.
For our first ever Era 50-50 podcast.
Very exciting.
Thank you.
Thank you for having me.
Since we spoke to Alison, they've actually begun filming series 3 of Harlots, which is great news and something for us all to look forward to. If you haven't had the chance to check it out yet, series 1 and 2 can be found on Amazon Prime. So if you've got Amazon Prime, fantastic, go and check it out. If you haven't, steal somebody else's. That's what I do. But yeah, thanks again to Alison for inviting us into her home on a Sunday. Yeah. With her dog. Her dog is wonderful.
A lovely dog. Mm. Thank you, Alison. So every episode, we want to champion women's stories, work that promotes 50-50 casting and creative teams. So for this first episode, we wanted to talk about the most talked about show on at the West End at the moment, Amelia. It has an all-female cast, all-female creative team, written by Morgan Lloyd-Malcolm and directed by Nicola Charles.
If you haven't seen the show, then here is a little bit about it. 400 years ago, Amelia Bassano wanted her voice to be heard. It wasn't. Her voice is still our story. Amelia and her sisters reach out to us across the centuries with passion, fury, laughter and song. Listen to them, let them inspire and unite us. Times are finally changing. Not fast enough. It's up to you. We are all Amelia. Stand up alongside her and be counted.
It's the most incredibly galvanising, empowering show. So last night, George and I went to capture the buzz that it creates. And here's what some of the audience members had to say.
Empowered.
Oh, so
angry.
Empowered.
Inspired.
Funny.
Brilliant.
Furious. Jubilant.
Empowering.
It fuels literally a fire inside of you to make you want to do things to make better things happen for other people.
I think it's amazing what theatre can do when it takes, you know, the platform of communicating with a large group of people in a very interactive way and decides to really make the message the heart of it. Like, I just feel really empowered. I feel really empowered. I feel like I could say anything and everyone has to kind of listen.
How do you feel after that?
Elated in some ways and angry with other things. Because I've realised it too late. Not too late, but, you know, later than I wanted to.
Empowered as well, though.
Yeah.
I think that's very a good way of describing it.
Very moved. There's a great deal of representation, I think, both in the storytelling and in the actresses involved in the play.
I think one of the things I really liked is the way that it interwove words. The whole thing of borrowing words, of borrowing language, and the fact that Shakespeare borrowed and taking that back and reappropriating language and making it owned by everyone, I think was one of the most powerful things. And I think that culminated in the end with a kind of final speech about ownership of your experience of anger of generations, centuries, millennia of women.
History.
Yeah.
Who owns history, who writes the history books, and being able to take a chance to rewrite some of that. We don't know what those voices were because they were not heard at the time.
The reflections of how ridiculous men can seem and how capable women are when operating, you know, individually in groups.
We weren't really sure what to expect, and it really took everyone on a journey, and like ending with that message that sort of calling everyone to go out and do something makes you feel like you just need to go and talk to people about this and keep telling
it was
story
a really powerful
as well.
Ending to
yeah
what was a really
I've
powerful
never been to a show
no.
like it before
no
so.
Neither yeah it was brilliant.
The ending is the most memorable part for me because I've never seen anything like that before, like just leading into the applause and everyone kind of coming together.
The comedy in it was beautiful and very, very real.
It was really, really good. I really enjoyed it. I'd recommend lots of people to go to see.
I mean, it's rooted in history. It's an untold story. Like, I think a very interesting perspective that we all should kind of at least see and hopefully kind of embrace as well.
The story of a woman you probably don't know about but should.
The story of every woman who was erased.
Just go see it.
Go
My God,
it.
Why haven't you seen it yet?
Time is up.
Kind of makes you want to tackle the world after. That's how I feel.
As you can hear, people are completely impassioned by this show. I have never been among an audience that has created such a visceral experience in a yeah. theatre show. You would be absolutely mad to miss it. So do yourselves a favour. It closes on the 1st of June at the Vaudeville Theatre on the Strand in London. See it if you can. Travel to see it. This is a historic play. Yeah. It's going...
Believe the hype.
Yeah, believe
so
the hype
good.
For this one. It's fantastic.
So good. You don't want to miss it.
If you would like to join the conversation that Era 5050 has started, then we welcome you to join us. Head over to our website, which is era5050.co.uk. That's era5050.co.uk, where you can see and see about what we've been up to and learn about more about what we do. And you can also buy one of our famous badges and donate to the campaign.
Follow us on Twitter and Instagram at era50_50. Or if you'd like to get in touch with me and Rose directly about the podcast or anything else that takes your fancy, please email us at podcast@era5050.co.uk.
We have a huge team to thank now. We wouldn't be able to do this without our producer, George Jennings.
Thank you, George.
Thank you, over there in the corner. Spotlight for their ongoing support. To Charlotte Bevan, Suzanne Diakin and the team at the National Theatre for all of their support over the past few months and for the use of their studio where we record the podcast.
To all our interviewees for this episode, to the Era Warriors that keep the campaign going and the fight strong, Oliver Hoare for composing our music, and also a huge shout out to Imogen Greenberg, who very early doors gave us some amazing pearls of wisdom about podcasting. So we'd like to put a link to her website in the episode notes to say thank you to.
Thanks for joining us for the first episode of the New Era podcast. Please, if you would rate and review us, give us a 5-star if you fancy it, because it helps other people find us.
There's so much more to say, so please do join us in 2 weeks' time for the next episode, and thank you very much for listening.